You are a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people for God's possession, so that you may publicly declare the strong deeds of the one who called you out of darkness into his marvelous light. 1 Peter chapter 2, verses 5 and 9. Here, in line with many other New Testament passages, Peter takes the basic Israel vocation and declares boldly that it has now become the fulfilled Israel vocation. Fulfilled Israel means primarily Jesus himself, Israel's Messiah, but the vocation then extends to all those who follow and belong to him. Jesus is the one true living stone, and his followers are the living stones by which the true temple is to be built, bringing the presence of God into the wider world, carrying forward the mission of declaring God's powerful and rescuing acts, and beginning the work of implementing the messianic rule of Jesus in all the world. This is what it means to be a royal priesthood. The rest of 1 Peter makes it clear what this does not mean. It does not mean that Jesus' followers are at once to set themselves up as world rulers, or even local rulers in the ordinary sense. We know of some local government officials who became Christians in the very early period, but that is an unlooked-for mercy at this stage, not something that of itself will be seen as an anticipation of the eventual vocation to be rulers and priests. Far from it. First, Peter is full of warnings about persecution, and instructions to those who find themselves suffering from it. Rather, in some sense, which the writer does not explore explicitly, this very status of the early Christians, as people rejected by the world around and yet living lives of holiness and hope, is what the royal priesthood should expect to look like. This is how Jesus' messianic rule is brought to bear in powerful witness upon the world. The message that Jesus, the crucified Jesus, is the world's true Lord, is to be made known precisely through the churches following in his footsteps. Chapters 2, verses 21 through 23. 4. Once we get our heads around the vision and vocation of Revelation, and of 1 Peter chapter 2, we notice one or two other key passages in the New Testament which express the same idea. The first of these passages comes in the middle of a paragraph so dense that the reader can easily pass over it without realizing what is actually being said. The passage in question comes at the point where Paul is summing up the first four chapters of the letter to the Romans so that he can thereby construct a platform for the next four chapters, with the first eight chapters then forming a further solid platform for what he wants to say in chapters 9 through 16. The passage we are looking at, in other words, is not an aside, a throwaway line without reference to the real substance of Paul's thought in general or in this letter. It is central and vital. This is the point where Paul, as it were, climbs a high mountain from whose pinnacle he can survey the entire landscape of God's plan from the first days through to the final result. Paul does this principally by contrasting Adam, the first man, who was given God's great commands but who disobeyed, with Jesus Christ, who was obedient to God's saving purpose and thus rescued the human race. Paul is declaring, in other words, that our calling as followers of Jesus is to be genuine human beings at last. Thus, therefore, just as sin came into the world through one human being and death through sin, and in that way death spread to all humans, in that all sinned. Sin was in the world, you see, even in the absence of the law, though sin is not calculated when there is no law. But death reigned from Adam to Moses, even over the people who did not sin by breaking a command, as Adam had done. Adam, who was an advanced prototype of the one who would come. But it isn't as the trespass, so also the gift. For if many died by one person's trespass, how much more has God's grace and the gifting grace through the one person, Jesus the Messiah, abounded to the many? And nor is it, as through the sin of the one, so also the gift. For the judgment which followed the one trespass resulted in a negative verdict, but the free gift which followed many trespasses resulted in a positive verdict. Chapter 5, verses 12 through 16. And then, two verses later, triumphantly, so then, just as, though the trespass of one person, the result was condemnation for all people, even so, through the upright act of one person, the result is justification and life for all people. For just as through the disobedience of one person many received the status of sinner, so through the obedience of one person many will receive the status of in the right. Verses 18 to 19. Dense and complicated. Well, yes. But in principle we can, I think, see what Paul is saying. Here is Adam, called to a great destiny and losing it by his disobedience. Here is Jesus Christ, called to undo the resultant mess, to get the human project back on track, and being obedient to that calling and thereby accomplishing it. We can get our minds around that. But the contrast Paul is drawing isn't just between Adam and Jesus Christ. It is between the status and role which humans have as a result of Adam's disobedience and that which they will have as a result of Jesus Christ's obedience. Most Christians today, I strongly suspect, have never really thought of their role in those terms and are probably not prepared for it. Thus, in the verse we omitted a moment ago, Paul goes beyond what many might expect him to say and declares that humans are not only rescued through Jesus Christ, but are placed in authority over God's new world. For if, by the trespass of the one, death reigned through that one, how much more will those who receive the abundance of grace and the gift of covenant membership, of being in the right, how much more will they reign in life through the one man, Jesus the Messiah? Chapter 5, verse 17. How much more will they reign? What is he saying and why is he saying it? This, together with Revelation, is the telltale sign that the Christian vision of a genuinely human existence goes way beyond Aristotle's happiness and into a different sphere altogether. Aristotle dreamed of a world where humans would learn the virtues so that they might exercise leadership within the political order of the ancient Greek city. Paul speaks of a world where humans will be put in charge of the whole creation. He sends us back, in fact, to the very foundation of what it means to be human. This is where we need to begin if we are to see how being human can become an art we can practice, a language we can learn, a goal, a telos, toward which we can begin to take some serious steps here and now. Paul is here drawing on the ancient Jewish tradition which goes all the way back to Genesis chapter 1, verses 26 to 28. Jesus Christ has put the human project back on track, actually more than back on track. It was all along God's project through human beings for the whole world. In Jesus the Messiah, God has indeed overcome the problem caused by the eating of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, but he has done more than that. He has also led the human race at last to taste the tree of life. That is what Jesus' resurrection is all about, which is why, back once more in Revelation chapter 22, we find the tree of life growing beside the river that flows out of the city, chapter 22 verses 1 and 2. Humans are called, in and through Jesus Christ, to become what they were always made to be. And what they were made for can be summarized in one single word, glory. Glory is a standard biblical way of referring to the wise rule of humans over creation. Glory isn't simply a quality that individuals might or might not possess in and for themselves, a splendor, a status, a condition to be admired. Glory is an active quality. It is the glorious human rule through which the world is brought to its intended flourishing state, and through which humans themselves come to their own intended flourishing. It is, in fact, the glory of God, the effective rank and status which shows that humans are indeed the God-reflectors, the ones through whom the loving, wise sovereignty of the Creator God is brought into powerful, life-giving presence within creation. This, too, once more, is a temple theme. The glory of Yahweh abandoned the temple at the time of the exile and never returned. But the promise of such a return remained in passages such as Isaiah chapter 40 verses 3 through 5, chapter 52 verses 7 through 10, Ezekiel chapter 43 verses 1 through 9, Zechariah chapter 2 verses 10 through 12, and Malachi chapter 3 verses 1 through 4, awaiting fulfillment. Yes, says Paul, humans lost the glory of God through their sin, chapter 3 verse 23, but now they are promised it will be restored, as redeemed humans receive access to grace, like priests allowed to enter the very Holy of Holies, and in consequence celebrate the hope of God's glory, chapter 5, verse 2. That is precisely what Romans chapter 5, verse 17 is declaring. And notice what happens as a result. Romans chapter 5, verses 1 and 2 introduces one of the passages where it is most clear that Paul is thinking of the future goal as the thing which forms character in the present. We celebrate, he says, in our sufferings, knowing that suffering produces patience, and patience produces a tried and tested character, and character produces hope, hope which does not disappoint us, because the love of God has been poured into our hearts through the Holy Spirit, chapter 5, verses 3 to 5. This is one of those dense Pauline passages which draw together several large and interlocking worlds of reference. It is about the new temple, filled with God's own glory and through the Spirit, presence. It is about the new humanity, called to a life of anticipating the eventual royal priesthood status through the development of appropriate character. And it is about the living God, creating this new temple through Jesus Christ and then filling it with his own presence. Redeemed humans, then, are to share the reign of Jesus Christ over the new world. But what will be the result of this reign? Nothing short of the renewal of the whole world. The next three chapters of Romans explore the great story, which first emerges from Paul's summary in chapter 5. Modeled on the Exodus from Egypt, when the royal priesthood vocation was first articulated, of how humans are rescued from the state of slavery and enabled to become genuine human beings at last. And when they do, the creation project will at last get back on track. The climax of this is the great statement that when humans are fully restored, the creation itself will then be fully restored, so that instead of the slavery of decay and corruption, it will be given the freedom of the glory of the children of God. Chapter 8, verse 21. In other words, when God's children, the redeemed human race, are glorified, set at last, as was always intended, in obedient authority over the world, then the whole creation will heave a gigantic sigh of relief and become truly what it always had the capacity to become, but what, through the failure of humans to govern it with the glory God had in mind, it failed to attain. Thus Paul returns in his concluding summary to what he said in chapter 5, verse 17, that those who receive the gift of righteousness will reign. Those he justified, them he also glorified. Chapter 8, verse 30. To glorify here means, more or less, to set in glorious authority over the world. That is the hope. When God redeems the whole creation, redeemed humans will play the key role, resuming the wise, healing sovereignty over the whole world for which God made them in the first place. Very well. If that is the telos, the goal for which we were made, to say it again, notice how different this is already from any kind of Aristotelian happiness, and also how different from so many would-be Christian visions of redeemed bliss, then we must ask the question, in what ways is this glory anticipated in the present? How do we learn, in the present, the habits of mind and heart which point us in the direction of this eventual reign? We shall return to this later in more detail, but let's just notice, within the immediate context of Romans, the two clear answers Paul gives. The ways of anticipating this glorious rule in the present are not, as skeptics might imagine, a regime of getting in practice for running things by learning how to throw your weight about, how to be bossy and tyrannical. The two ways he outlines are holiness and prayer. First, the path to the glory which he expounds in the passage just referred to is the path of costly self-denial, that is, of holiness. So then, brothers and sisters, we are debtors, but not to the flesh, to live in accordance with the flesh. If you live in accordance with the flesh, you see, you will die. But if by the Spirit you put to death the deeds of the body, you will live. For all who are led by God's Spirit are God's children. You didn't receive a spirit of slavery, after all, to make you go back to fear. Rather, you received the spirit of sonship, the one in whom we shout out, Abba, Father. When that happens, that very Spirit is bearing witness with our spirit that we are God's children. And if children, then heirs. Heirs of God and joint heirs with the Messiah, provided we suffer with him so that we can also be glorified with him. Chapter 8, verses 12 through 17. There we have it. The goal is the glorification of God's children, which as we have just seen turns out to be their redemptive sovereignty over the whole creation. But the path by which they are to get to that goal is the path of freedom marked out for God's children. Paul is here deliberately echoing the story of the Exodus, the time when Israel, God's firstborn son, was rescued from slavery and led by God himself through the wilderness to the promised inheritance. Within that story, the people were sometimes tempted to go back to Egypt, to the state of slavery. But they had to resist that temptation. They had to follow God's personal leading all the way to the promised land. So it is for those who belong to the Messiah, who are in fact his fellow heirs. God had promised the Messiah that he would give him the whole world for his inheritance. Psalm chapter 2, verse 8, another scriptural passage dear to Paul's heart. Now it appears this worldwide inheritance is to be shared with all the Messiah's people. That is what Romans chapter 8 verses 18 through 30 is all about. But if they are called to be God's free and freedom-bringing people, then they must learn to live as God's free people, giving up the habit of slavery. Yes, slavery is as much a habit of mind as a physical state, and learning the art of responsible, free living. To put it another way, if these people are to take redemptive responsibility for the whole of creation, they must anticipate that by taking redemptive responsibility, in the present time, for that one bit of creation over which they have the most obvious control, namely their own bodies. Notice Paul's subtle shift of language. For him, flesh is always a negative term, indicating either the corruptible and decaying nature of our present state or actual rebellion against God, and sometimes both together. To live according to the flesh, then, is to live the life of rebellion whose natural end, not an arbitrary punishment, but but the fulfillment of the pattern of the life which is being led is death. But God intends to raise the body from death, as in chapter 8, verse 11. If the spirit of the one who raised Jesus from the dead dwells in you, he who raised the Messiah from the dead will also give life to your mortal bodies through his spirit who dwells in you. For this to happen, the things to which the body might naturally incline through the pull of the flesh, in other words, those actions growing out of the slave instinct of the rebellion against God the freedom giver, must themselves be put to death. This, it seems, is what happens through the suffering in which the Christian is joined with the suffering of the Messiah. So the telos, the goal of being glorified over the creation, is to be anticipated in the present by replacing the slave habits of mind, heart, and body with freedom habits, habits that both share in God's freedom themselves and bring that freedom to the world. That is more or less what Paul understands by holiness or sanctification, the learning in the present of the habits which anticipate the ultimate future. But that sovereign and redemptive rule of renewed humans over God's world is also anticipated in the present time through prayer. The whole creation, he says, is groaning in labor pains, longing for the birth of the new creation from the womb of the old. Chapter 8, verse 22. We ourselves, within that creation, find ourselves groaning as we await our own adoption as sons and daughters, the redemption of our bodies. Chapter 8, verse 23. But precisely in that state, as we are longing for and anticipating the final glorification, the Spirit is also at work within us, groaning without words, and thus enabling us, even when we don't know what to pray for as we ought, nevertheless to be interceding for the whole world. Chapter 8, verses 26 and 27. This essentially priestly vocation, standing before God with his whole creation in our hearts, joins up with the vision of royal sovereignty over creation, and is one of its key aspects. This passage offers one of the strangest, but also most moving descriptions in the whole New Testament of what the Christian understands by prayer. The inarticulate groaning, in which the pain of the world is felt most keenly at the point where it is also being brought by the Spirit into the very presence of God the Creator. This is central in the present time to the entire human vocation. Learning this language is the second key habit which forms the pathway to the eventual goal, the goal of royal priesthood. In other words, the present anticipation of the future glory consists not in lording it over creation, imagining ourselves already its masters, able to tyrannize it and bend it to our will. It consists rather in the humble, Christ-like, Spirit-led activity of prayer, the prayer in which the love of God is poured into our hearts by the Spirit, chapter 5, verse 5, so that the extraordinary and almost unbelievable hope that is set before us is nevertheless firm and secure, chapter 5, verses 1 through 5, chapter 8, verses 28 through 30. Thus, at the heart of arguably the greatest chapter of certainly his greatest letter, Paul sets out the pattern of present anticipation of future hope. This is what virtue is all about. The hope is that all those who are in Christ and are indwelt by the Spirit will eventually reign in glory over the whole creation, thereby taking up at long last the role commanded for humans in Genesis 1 and Psalm 8, and sharing the inheritance and the final rescuing work of the Messiah himself, as in Psalm 2. And if that is the telos, the goal, it is to be anticipated in the present by the settled habits of holiness and prayer. If this is what Paul means by the final reign and its present strange anticipation, we observe that alongside this vision at every point in his writings is his equal emphasis that the Spirit comes to dwell in the hearts and lives of believers, inspiring precisely this holiness, this prayer, this love, and this hope. But this theme of indwelling of the Spirit, see Romans chapter 8, verses 5 through 11, Ephesians chapter 3, verse 17, is nothing other than Paul's vision of the church, Christ's people as the new temple, as in 1 Corinthians chapter 3, verses 10 through 17, chapter 6, verses 19 and 20, and Ephesians chapter 2, verses 11 through 21. Just as Israel's God dwelt in the old temple, and its predecessor, the wilderness tabernacle, leading the people from Egypt to the promised land, so now God's own Spirit dwells within his people, leading them from previous slavery to future ultimate freedom. The Spirit thus enables God's people to be a community of priests, gathering up the worship of creation, just as the Spirit also constitutes God's people as rulers, bringing God's wise healing order to the world. And the Spirit, as we shall see, is vital for the quest and practice of virtue. The early Christians did not suppose they were undertaking that quest and that practice in their own unaided strength. This is one of the great watersheds in the whole discussion of virtue. Whereas Aristotle's virtuous man was encouraged to take pride in his self-made character, The classic Christian stance is seen in Paul's insistence, "Yet it was not I, but the grace of God that was with me," 1 Corinthians chapter 15, verse 10. 5. Three further New Testament passages fill out this vision of God's intended future and the way in which it is to be anticipated in the present. First, we have another Pauline passage which I suspect is so surprising to most modern readers that it is passed over in silence and quickly forgotten. One of you even has the nerve to go to court with a neighbor, to be judged before unrighteous people rather than before God's saints. Don't you know that the saints will judge the world? And if the world is to be judged by you, are you unworthy of judging lesser things? Don't you know that we shall judge angels? So why not matters relating to the present life? So if you have ordinary lawsuits, are you going to appear before judges who are, in the eyes of the church, people of no account? I say this is your shame. Is it really the case that you haven't got anybody among you who is wise, who can judge between one Christian and another? 1 Corinthians chapter 6, verses 1 through 5. As often when Paul says, "Don't you know?" as he does twice here in quick succession, we want to reply, "No, we don't, actually." But Paul seems to be quite clear. There will one day be a judgment when the secrets of all hearts will be disclosed. Romans chapter 2, verses 1 through 16, chapter 14, verse 10, 1 Corinthians chapter 4, verse 5, 2 Corinthians chapter 5, verse 10, etc. Jesus himself will be the supreme judge. Romans chapter 2, verse 16, Acts chapter 17, verse 31. But there will, it seems, be a role within this activity of judgment for the saints, God's people more largely. That is what, according to this passage, Paul expects the Corinthians to take for granted. Why? Presumably because Paul, like most early Christians, took Daniel 7 very seriously. The holy ones of the Most High shall receive the kingdom and possess the kingdom forever. Then judgment was given for the holy ones of the Most High, and the time arrived when the holy ones gained possession of the kingdom. The kingship and dominion of the greatness of the kingdoms under the whole heaven shall be given to the people of the holy ones of the Most High. Their kingdom shall be an everlasting kingdom, and all dominions shall serve and obey them. Daniel chapter 7 verses 18, 22, and 27. In its original setting, this prophecy made the striking claim that the Jewish people, or the faithful remnant among them, will be set in authority over the kingdoms of the world after their terrible suffering at the hands of the beasts. What has happened to this prophecy within the early Christian understanding? The primary answer seems to be clear. It has been fulfilled in Jesus Christ himself, and his vindication and exaltation by God after his suffering at the hands of the wicked. This is part at least of what the gospel writers understand when they record Jesus speaking of himself as Son of Man, e.g. Mark chapter 14, verse 62. The phrase is still highly controversial, but I have no doubt that Daniel chapter 7, verse 13, with its vision of one like a son of man, stands closely behind its main uses. But already within early Christianity, it appears that what was thereby claimed for Jesus was claimed also for his people. The plural reference elsewhere in Daniel chapter 7, the holy ones of the Most High, who receive royal power, has become plural again after the singular use in the Gospels, so that even the muddled and misguided Corinthians were going to share the promised rule, the judging activity of the Messiah. So much so that Paul could expect some at least of them to act as wise judges even in the present time. That which is going to be true in the future, he is saying, must be anticipated in the present. Or at least that is what the church should expect and work toward. Don't hire pagan lawyers, he says. One of your own number will have what it takes. After all, in God's new world you're all going to be judges. This may perhaps explain the second passage, also from 1 Corinthians, where Paul, speaking with heavy irony, chides his hearers about the way they are giving themselves airs. Who is going to concede superiority to you, after all? What have you got that you didn't receive? Well then, if you received it, why boast as if you didn't? Do you really suppose you've already had all the food you need? Do you think you've already become rich? Do you think you've already been crowned as royalty, leaving us behind? I wish you really were already reigning, so that we could reign alongside you. 1 Corinthians chapter 4, verses 7 and 8. The sentences I have punctuated here as questions could also be read as ironic statements. You're already full. You're already rich. You've already become kings without us. Paul's response shows that he thinks these boasts are empty, but also that there is a serious theological point underneath. They are meant to be kings, in quite a new sense, but their present way of behaving is simply colluding with the normal, old sense in which people of importance puff themselves up and give themselves airs. But that doesn't undermine the striking claim made at the end of the previous chapter. So don't let anyone boast about mere human beings. For everything belongs to you, whether it's Paul or Apollos or Cephas, whether it's the world or life or death, whether it's the present or the future, everything belongs to you. And you belong to the Messiah, and the Messiah belongs to God. 1 Corinthians chapter 3, verses 21 to 23. Everything belongs to you. There is the theological principle behind all this, and however much the Corinthians have twisted it so that it fits into their pre-existing cultural expectations, it remains valid and powerful. Those who are in the Messiah already share in his royal status. However much that royal status has been radically redefined around the cross, and the first four chapters of 1 Corinthians are written to make exactly that point, it remains the true royal status, the status of the true world ruler. That is the status that God's people in Christ now share. This mind-boggling sharing of Jesus' royal task in bringing God's justice to the world emerges in the pastoral epistles as well. In 2 Timothy chapter 2, verses 8 to 13, we find the following. Remember Jesus the Messiah, raised from the dead, from the seed of David, in accordance with my gospel. I suffer everything because of God's chosen ones, so that they too may obtain salvation which is in the Messiah, Jesus, with eternal glory. The saying is sure. If we have died with him, we shall also live with him. If we endure, we shall also reign with him. If we deny him, he will also deny us. If we are faithless, he remains faithful, for he cannot deny himself. We shall also reign with him. That remains the promise and the hope, the goal toward which the New Testament points. In the new heavens and the new earth, those who belong to Jesus will share his sovereign rule over his new world. If it wasn't Paul who wrote 2 Timothy, and most scholars think it wasn't, it was someone closely in tune at this point with what Paul himself says in Romans and 1 Corinthians. And in each case, we note, the point is not argued as a new idea, one that the early Christians wouldn't have expected to hear. It is stated as something they were expected to know already, to take for granted. The same point, finally, is stated explicitly by Jesus himself in Matthew's Gospel. The passage in question, chapter 19, verses 28 through 30, is one which even skeptics have declared likely to have come from Jesus' own lips. This is partly because the saying appears to be Israel-specific, whereas Jesus' followers, and indeed Matthew himself, quickly concern themselves with the wider world beyond Israel. Thus, it is highly unlikely that such a saying would have been invented later. It is also, even more strikingly, peculiar and uninventable, because it seems to assign a place in the final judgment even to the traitor Judas. Nobody in the early church would have made that up. The saying comes when Jesus, following the incident with the rich young man, is replying to Peter's question about the coming future. Truly I tell you, in the reborn world, when the Son of Man will sit on the throne of his glory, those of you who have followed me will sit, yes, you, on 12 thrones, judging the 12 tribes of Israel. And everyone who has left houses, or brothers, or sisters, or father, or mother, or children, or lands for the sake of my name will receive 100-fold and inherit the life of the coming age. But many who are first will be last, and the last first. Matthew chapter 19, verses 28 to 30. This, like 1 Corinthians chapter 6, is probably dependent on Daniel chapter 7. Jesus assumes that, since he is the Messiah who is inaugurating God's kingdom, he and his followers will be entrusted with the judgment by which God will sort everything out at last. Once this passage is in place, we may draw in as well the New Testament's more generalized but still powerful promises about servants who, having been faithful in a little, are then to be entrusted with much. Matthew chapter 25 verses 21 and 23, Luke chapter 19 verses 17 and 19. So too, we may suppose, we can include the sheep who, without realizing it, have already in the present been ministering to the one whom they will subsequently meet as their judge. Matthew chapter 25 verses 34 to 40. And once we include those passages, we begin to realize that actually a very great deal of what Jesus had to say about the coming kingdom and the role of his followers within it is in fact about God's coming rule of the whole world, setting it the right way up at last, and about the way in which those who follow him in the present time are to anticipate, here and now, the role which they are to be given in that ultimate future. For the full foundation of the Christian reshaping of virtue, in other words, we must look primarily to Jesus himself. As the very early Christians recognized, he had fulfilled the human roles, the Israel roles of king and priest. He had brought the great stories of Israel, of human, and of the world to their climax. He represented in himself the communities that had been called to carry forward the God-given vocation, and he had summoned people to follow him and share that story, that community, and that vocation. It is now time to look, directly and in some detail, at Jesus himself, and at the challenge and invitation he offered to his contemporaries. Chapter 4. The Kingdom Coming and the People Prepared. 1. When I was first studying theology, some of the scholars whose works I read used to agonize over the Sermon on the Mount. You'll find it in Matthew chapter 5, verse 7. A different version of some of the same material is found in Luke chapter 6, verses 20 through 49. Everybody knew, of course, that in the great and glorious gospel preached by St. Paul, people are justified by faith, not by works. So why, the scholars wondered, did Jesus appear to start off his preaching by telling people how to live, what to do and not to do? Surely giving them rules for living would simply encourage them into bad spiritual habits, into imagining that they could make themselves good enough for God by their own efforts. One answer that some theologians used to give to this question went like this. Well, yes, it's true that Paul's gospel was about faith, not about how we should live. But Matthew's gospel wasn't written as primary evangelism. It was written for people who are already Christians. They had already accepted Jesus and the salvation offered through him by faith alone. Now they needed to be instructed on how to live, not to save themselves by their own efforts, but to respond appropriately to God's grace. I think, for instance, of the careful and thoughtful book on the Sermon on the Mount by the great scholar Joachim Jeremias, who took more or less this line. I think, too, of a lecture in Oxford many years ago by the well-known Lutheran Günther Bornkamm, who managed to demonstrate that, despite appearances, Matthew wasn't actually a legalist. Why not? Because he was, after all, not only facing Pharisees to the right of him, but also enthusiasts to the left of him, people who were casting off all moral restraint and who thought that because they were following Jesus, not the Jewish law, they could do whatever they liked. Matthew, it thus appeared, was warding off legalism in one direction and antinomianism in the other, just as Martin Luther himself had done. This conclusion was reached, it seemed to me at the time, with something like a sigh of relief. I remember being suspicious about this approach at the time. It all seemed to fit just a bit too well, but I didn't have anything much to suggest by way of an alternative. Since then, I have observed the way in which people who offer the same kind of reading of the text tend to frame everything in terms not of what Jesus himself meant when he said particular words under discussion, but of what the evangelist, Matthew, or whoever meant. This way of reading the Gospels is still popular, and at some level it is healthy. Part of human maturity, after all, is learning to read everything with a questioning eye, whether it's this morning's newspaper, in which journalists may have misrepresented things in order to tell the story they wanted to tell, rather than what actually happened, or somebody's sacred text. Can we trust it? Who wrote it and why? In the same way, many people suppose that learning to read the Gospels involves learning to read between the lines and discovering that what's actually going on isn't really about Jesus at all, but about Matthew's, or Mark's, or Luke's, or John's theology, about the life of their communities and so on. This seems mature, sophisticated, grown up, and of course at one level it is. Everybody who writes history, everybody who writes a newspaper article on what happened yesterday, and for that matter everybody who tells somebody else what I just saw in the street, selects and arranges the material. You can't say everything, and if you try you'll be at it all day, and very boring it will be too. So we all select and arrange, and anyone reading what we write can, in principle, try to discover why we've done it the way we have. But this appearance of sophistication can easily mask a dangerous sophistry. The fact that it's all been selected and arranged doesn't mean it's all been made up. In my part of the world, there are three soccer teams that nurse a huge local rivalry. Whenever they play one another, it's fascinating to read the accounts in the different local newspapers. You get quite a different angle on whether the referee was right to give that crucial penalty, whether the left winger was really offside, whether both players who were fighting should have been sent off or only one of them. But all the newspapers will still tell you who won the game, what the score was, and so on. If we thought they were making that up, we wouldn't buy the newspapers in the first place. I have gone into this little digression on the question of history and the Gospels, a tiny fragment from a much longer discussion we could have had, for one reason only. I have become increasingly convinced that a method of reading the Gospels which has been popular among Western scholars for many years is not only flawed in itself, offering an apparently sophisticated reading while denying something quite basic, that Jesus really did and said substantially what the Gospels say he did and said, but is flawed for a particular reason directly related to the subject of this book. It is flawed because the whole worldview driving the scholarship in question screened out the very possibility that there might be a larger truth that the Gospels were trying to express, but that didn't fit into the categories the scholars had available. And that larger truth, in which the Sermon on the Mount makes the excellent sense it does, is this. God's future is arriving in the present, in the person and work of Jesus, and you can practice right now the habits of life which will find their goal in that coming future. This is, if you like, Jesus' answer to Aristotle. Here is the goal, the telos. Not happiness in the sense of Aristotle's eudaimonia, but blessedness in the Hebrew sense of ashrei or baruch, Greek makarios. That, by the way, is why translations of the Beatitudes, that familiar series of sermon sayings announcing blessings, which say happy instead of blessed, are precisely missing the point. And the key point about bless, blessing, and blessed, one of the things that marks Jesus out over against Aristotle in terms of the source and driving energy of the virtues, is that this includes happiness, but it includes it as the result of something else, namely, the loving action of the Creator God. Happiness is simply a state of being for a human, as a self-contained unit. You might, in principle, attain it on your own and develop it for your own sake. Blessedness, however, is what happens when the Creator God is at work both in someone's life and through that person's life. Likewise, blessedness is what happens when this same God is fulfilling the promises he made to his ancient people, the promises contained in the covenant as set out in the closing chapters of Deuteronomy. And both of those, the human blessing and the Israel blessing, are evoked by Jesus' remarkable words in the opening of the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew chapter 5, verses 3 through 11. Blessings on the poor in spirit. The kingdom of heaven is yours. Blessings on the mourners. You're going to be comforted. Blessings on the meek. You're going to inherit the earth. Blessings on people who hunger and thirst for God's justice. You're going to be satisfied. Blessings on the merciful. You'll receive mercy yourselves. Blessings on the pure in heart. You will see God. Blessings on the peacemakers. You'll be called God's children. Blessings on people who are persecuted because of God's way. The kingdom of heaven belongs to you. Blessings on you when people slander you and persecute you, and say all kinds of wicked things about you falsely because of me. Celebrate and rejoice. There's a great reward for you in heaven. That's how they persecuted the prophets who went before you. These statements clearly are not describing the way things are. They are not suggesting that the mourners are already being comforted, despite appearances. They are not trying to teach hidden, timeless truths about a reality which is normally hidden behind a bleak facade. They are announcing a new state of affairs, a new reality which is in the process of bursting into the world. They are declaring that something that wasn't previously the case is now going to be, that the life of heaven, which had seemed so distant and unreal, is in the process of coming true on earth. What happens when we put these astonishing declarations into the format we set out at the end of chapter 2? 1. The goal is God's kingdom, a time of comfort, of heaven coming to earth at last, of the renewal of creation, of plenty, of mercy, of reward, and perhaps above all of seeing God himself. 2. This goal has arrived in the present, now that Jesus is here. How his public career will work out is, from the perspective of those listening to the Sermon on the Mount, not yet clear. 3. Those who follow Jesus can begin to practice, in the present, the habits of heart and life which correspond to the way things are in God's kingdom, the way they will be eventually, yes, but also the way they already are because Jesus is here. How does the ultimate promised future correspond to the present practices and habits Jesus insists upon? In two contrasting ways. On the one hand, there is a direct correspondence, where the future state is exactly anticipated in the present habits of life. Humility, meekness, mercy, purity, peacemaking. When the final kingdom arrives, we won't stop being humble, meek, and pure. That's enough of that. Now we can be what we've always wanted, namely proud, arrogant, and impure. No, these qualities will shine through all the more powerfully. On the other hand, there is the equal and opposite correspondence which demonstrates the tension between that inbreaking future and the way things still are in the present. Consider the mourners, the persecuted, those who are hungry for justice. When the final kingdom arrives, mourners will be comforted, justice hunger will be satisfied, and persecution will stop. Peacemaking belongs perhaps in both categories, since the attitude of heart that directs peacemaking corresponds directly to the peace of God's new world. But the need for actual peacemaking between warring parties will disappear when God's peace fills heaven and earth, as in the vision of Isaiah chapter 11. These two types of correspondence obviously go closely together. But the point of sayings of both types, direct correspondence and equal and opposite correspondence, is that Jesus is not meaning either, if you can manage to behave in this way, you will be rewarded, a kind of legalist solution, or now that you've believed in me and my kingdom project, this is how you must behave, the sort of thing some post-Reformation theology might insist on. Though the latter is closer to the truth, albeit not in the sense usually imagined. The shuttle between those two options is to remain impaled on the horns of a philosophical dilemma and its theological ramifications, rather than coming round the corner to see things from Jesus' very first century Jewish point of view. What Jesus is saying, rather, is, now that I'm here, God's new world is coming to birth, and once you realize that, you'll see that these are the habits of heart which anticipate that new world here and now. These qualities, purity of heart, mercy, and so on, are not, so to speak, things you have to do to earn a reward, a payment, nor are they merely the rules of conduct laid down for new converts to follow, rules that some today might perceive as somewhat arbitrary. They are in themselves the signs of life, the language of life, the life of new creation, the life of new covenant, the life which Jesus came to bring. And as we shall see, they are part of that radical Christian modification of the ancient Greek notion of virtue, the modification that quickly settled into the overall pattern of faith, hope, and love. 2. At this point, we could go straight into the rest of the Sermon on the Mount, beginning with Matthew chapter 5, verse 13, and work carefully all the way through. That isn't necessary for the argument I'm putting forward, but there are various things that need to be said to supplement the basic point already made. First, as we saw, the Beatitudes could be mistaken for a set of rules. They aren't, however. They are much more like virtues, and that's how they work. Grasp the end, the goal, the telos, the future, and go to work on anticipating it here and now. That doesn't mean, as I keep stressing, that there are no such things as rules. As we shall see, the Beatitudes are both guidelines for those who are learning virtue and a checklist to which virtuous Christians can refer to from time to time. But to read the Beatitudes as rules is to miss the point. Most of the rest of the sermon, though, could lead the casual modern reader in a very different direction. You must avoid not just murder but hatred, not just adultery but lust, and so on. Matthew chapter 5, verses 21 through 47. And when you give money, or say your prayers, or fast, you must really mean it, not simply go through the motions. Chapter 6, verses 1 through 18. All this could look as though Jesus were commending authenticity, in line with a romantic movement or existentialism. In other words, the outward forms don't matter. What matters is the attitude of the heart. But again, the sermon can't be drawn down into the categories offered by our contemporary moral discourse, as though Jesus were really saying pretty much what some of today's thinkers have urged. Jesus is in fact inviting his hearers to something much more radical, an anticipation of what we might call eschatological authenticity. Yes, there will be a time when God's people will serve and love him, and live out the genuine humanness of which ancient law had spoken, naturally and from the heart. But this will be a God-given second nature, a new way of being human. And you can begin to practice this now, difficult though it will be, because Jesus is here, inaugurating God's kingdom. It won't happen automatically, precisely because God wants you to be, as we might put it, humans rather than puppets. You will have to think about it, to struggle with it, to pray for grace and strength. But it is at least now within reach. You can't collapse the whole question of how to behave into the command, it must come naturally, otherwise it isn't authentic. Jesus puts it the other way round. He says, in effect, follow me and authenticity will begin to happen. The authenticity that really matters is living in accordance with the genuine human being God is calling you to become. What the ancient law really wanted, genuine human life, reflecting God's glory into the world, will start to appear The whole of the sermon is framed within Jesus' announcement that what his fellow Jews had longed for over many generations was now at last coming to pass. But that new kingdom didn't look like they had thought it would. Indeed, in some ways it went in exactly the other direction. No violence, no hatred of enemies, no anxious protection of land and property against the pagan hordes. In short, no frantic intensification of the ancestral codes of life. Rather a glad and unworried trust in the Creator God, whose kingdom is now at last starting to arrive, leading to a glad and generous heart toward other people, even those who are technically enemies. Faith, hope, and love. Here they are again. They are the language of life, the sign in the present of green shoots growing through the concrete of this sad old world, the indication that the Creator God is on the move, and that Jesus' hearers and followers can be part of what he is now doing. That is the context within which Jesus says perhaps the most remarkable thing of all. Be perfect, because your heavenly Father is perfect. Chapter 5, verse 48. The Greek is teleos, reminding us of Aristotle's telos, goal. You must be people of the goal, people of genuine humanness, people who are complete. It's the same word which, in Matthew's version of the story of the rich young ruler, chapter 19, verse 21, Jesus said to the young man, in effect, if you want to be complete, teleos, then go and sell your possessions, give to the poor, and come and follow me. The same word, too, is found in a similar context in James, chapter 3, verse 2. And we note that in each case, the perfection in question consists not of a long list of hard moral commands dutifully obeyed, but of a character formed by overflowing generous love. When Paul, as we shall see presently, sums up the calling of the Christian in terms of love, he is saying no more than what Jesus said in a variety of ways, and for that matter, no more than what Jesus did. Which points us to the question which is bound to arise at this stage in the argument. How on earth is Jesus' program for God's kingdom to be put into effect? He sends his followers out into the towns and villages, and they find to their delight and astonishment that the things he has been doing, particularly the healings which were such a striking sign of God's fresh power at work, are happening through them as well. Notice already, by the way, that the disciples are not given moral challenges to be tested on, as though the point of it all were whether their behavior was coming into line morally and ethically. That will follow, and the early signs are not particularly encouraging, as they squabble among themselves. Rather, they are given things to do through which God's new work can go forward. The language of life is the language in which God speaks through humans into the world. But was that all there was going to be to it? Just more followers of Jesus going out and bringing new life and hope into the tiny number of people their lives would touch, while most of the world rumbled on in the same way? Certainly not. Jesus had something far more radical in mind, something which decisively shaped the emerging movement of his followers. This is what set Jesus and his early followers dramatically apart in their pursuit of something we can call virtue from the other theories that go by that name. Basically, Jesus believed that God's future could be fully launched only if the forces ranged against it, the forces of chaos and destruction, of hatred and suspicion, of violence and pride and greed and ambition, were not just outflanked by a cheerful new alternative, but were confronted and defeated. This was at the heart of how he understood his own royal and priestly vocation. Through his own fresh and prayerful reading of Israel's scriptures, Jesus came to believe that this confrontation and defeat would come about through the twin roles of king and priest, through Israel's Messiah fighting the battle for the kingdom through his own suffering and death, and through Israel's true priest offering Israel's God the obedient sacrifice at the heart of the new temple. And, as a matter of vocation too deep for us fully to comprehend, Jesus believed that he himself was Israel's Messiah and Israel's priest, and that he would therefore suffer that victory-bringing, obedience-offering fate. How does this vocation, and its acting out in Jesus' death and resurrection, relate to the challenge he was presenting in the Sermon on the Mount and elsewhere, the challenge of the coming kingdom, the challenge to live in the present in the light of God's inbreaking future? 3. Jesus' forthcoming death, and his own deeply scriptural understanding, which led him not only to expect it but to interpret it in advance, is in fact tightly bound up with his announcement of God's kingdom and his invitation to his followers to start learning its language right now. So at least all four Gospels seem to be saying. For them, there is no clear demarcation between Jesus' kingdom announcement and his approaching death. The two belong closely together. But this brings us face to face with a problem which runs very deep within the whole of Western Christianity, and which, unless we deal with it head on, will get in the way of any attempt to understand the life of Christian virtue to which Jesus calls us, let alone the further question of how that relates to the other schemes of virtue on offer in the ancient or the modern world. Christians, particularly in the Western world, have for a long time been divided between epistles people and gospels people. The epistles people have thought of Christianity primarily in terms of Jesus' death and resurrection, saving us from our sins. The gospels people have thought primarily in terms of following Jesus in feeding the hungry, helping the poor, and so on. The epistles people have often found it difficult to give a clear account of what was going on in Jesus' kingdom announcement and his call to his followers to be perfect. The gospels people, or perhaps we should say, the beginning of the gospels people, since the line of thought they embrace usually screens out the last few chapters, have often found it difficult to explain why Jesus, who was doing these remarkable things, had to die, and die so soon. They have often found it difficult, in consequence, to relate to the central themes of Pauline theology. This either-or split does no justice, in fact, to either the epistles or the gospels. Still less does it do justice to Jesus himself. For him, the kingdom which he inaugurated could be firmly established only through his death and resurrection. Or to put it the other way around, the main purpose of his death and resurrection was to establish the kingdom he had already begun to inaugurate. The way the gospel writers tell the story of Jesus' death, with prolonged sections of preliminary teaching followed by quite detailed accounts of the hearings before the chief priests and the Roman governor, was chosen not for the sake of local color or mere historical reminiscence tacked onto the front of an event, the actual crucifixion, whose theological meaning must be culled from elsewhere. The meaning of the cross in the Gospels is that it is the execution of the kingdom bringer, the one who gathers up the royal and priestly vocations of Israel and of all the human race, the one who at the same time embodies Israel's God coming to establish his kingdom on earth as in heaven. The famous passages which encapsulate what later writers have thought of as atonement theology, such as Mark chapter 10, verse 45, "The Son of Man came not to be served but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many," are interpretive clues to understand one key dimension of what the whole story is about, not the superimposition of a supposedly Pauline theology about Jesus dying for our sins, on a narrative which is basically about something else. Likewise, for Paul, the death and resurrection of Jesus did not accomplish merely a supernatural salvation, having nothing to do with God's rescue of creation. As we saw in the previous chapter, for Paul, the whole point of the achievement of Jesus and his death and resurrection is that, through Jesus, a redeemed people has come to birth, and that through this people, the Creator will ultimately set the whole world to rights. The point of it all is new creation. 2 Corinthians chapter 5, verse 17, Galatians chapter 6, verse 15. The Gospels, the Epistles, and Revelation itself work only when you see them as detailed elaborations of the large, complex, but utterly coherent story we sketched earlier. The call of human to be God's image-bearer into creation, the call of Israel to be the rescuer of human, and the vocation of Jesus to be the one who, completing Israel's task, rescues human so that through redeemed humankind, the whole creation can be liberated from its corruption and death, and the project of new creation decisively launched. Shrink this narrative, or leave out one or more key stages within it, and you will never understand the New Testament as a whole, still less its call to learn the habits of heart and mind that anticipate the final goal. The split of viewpoints we have observed, then, is not so much between the Gospels and the Epistles, as between truncated readings of both, reflecting yet another great divide that has come over Western Christianity. The historical roots of this divide are fascinating, but this is not the moment to trace them back. Once again, part of the problem is that for many centuries Christians have assumed that virtually the only point in Jesus' death was to save us from our sins, understood in a variety of more or less helpful ways. But for the Gospels themselves, that rescue of individuals, which of course remains a central element, is designed to serve a larger purpose, God's purpose, the purpose of God's kingdom. And in God's kingdom, human beings are rescued, are delivered from their sin, in order to take their place, as Jesus already called the disciples to take theirs, not only as receivers of God's forgiveness and new life, but also as agents of it. In other words, rulers and priests. How then are Jesus' kingdom announcement and his saving death and resurrection integrated into a single whole? That, of course, is a large and overwhelming question, and it is with considerable temerity that I try a short and inevitably inadequate answer. Approach it like this. Jesus is not going about announcing God is becoming king into neutral territory, like an explorer annexing land that was previously unoccupied. He is announcing God's sovereign and saving rule, and doing things which demonstrate its presence and power in a world already governed by hostile powers, powers which to our horror include the ruling officials of God's people itself, not least the royal and priestly elites, and also the popular pressure groups and the revolutionary movements within Israel, in addition, of course, to the powers of the pagan world. Saying that God was becoming king in first century Palestine was a way of saying that Israel's God was dethroning pagan overlords and rescuing his people. But the people themselves, it seems, had become part of the problem. But, since the whole point of God's saving rule, as Jesus understood it, is that it is the saving rule of this God, the God of gentle, generous, overwhelming love, whose kingdom way was already articulated in the Sermon on the Mount, it cannot be established by force majeure, but only by its proper means, suffering and self-giving love. Hence the deep level integration of the message of the kingdom and the vocation of the cross, and hence the deep level resistance within Western culture to such an integration at any level. We have preferred our kingdoms to be of a different sort, and have preferred to see the shameful death of Jesus as bringing about a purely heavenly salvation. So too, this is a major theme in John's Gospel, but it's all over the place in the other three as well, Jesus is discovered to be the one in whom God's glory has finally returned to his people. Jesus is, clearly in John and implicitly in the others, the temple in person, the place where Israel's God has come to dwell in fulfillment of his ancient promise. That is why, throughout the Gospel narratives, but particularly when Jesus goes to Jerusalem for the last time, there is a direct confrontation between the two of them, Jesus and the temple, with the latter institution represented, of course, by the chief priests and the high priest himself. This, again, is not merely an accidental bit of local color, and it is certainly not to be reduced simply to the idea of the religious establishment opposing a free-spirited Jesus who is advocating a kind of spontaneous spirituality over against their supposed formalism. Rather, the references to Jesus and temple convey that just as Jesus is announcing the kingdom and is himself the true, though very surprising, king, so also is he embodying the true temple and is himself the true, though shocking, high priest. Jesus thus embodies the two great narratives of Israel, the royal and the priestly strands of the Old Testament, drawing them together and establishing the new way, the royal and priestly way, for Israel and for the human race, for the sake of the world. It is because of this double accomplishment that the human vocation of Genesis chapter 1 and chapter 2 can be reaffirmed, as we saw in the previous chapter in relation to Revelation, Romans, and other texts. The deepest revolution in virtue that we find at the heart of the Gospel, and of the Gospels, is found just here. Jesus shouldered the burden, not so much of sin in the abstract, in a kind of transaction which took place away from the actual events that led to his death, but rather of the actual weight, the power and results, of human sin and rebellion, the accumulation of the actual human pride, sin, folly and shame which, at that moment in history, concentrated themselves in the arrogance of Rome, the self-seeking of the Jewish leaders, and the distorted dreams of the Jewish revolutionaries, and indeed the failures of Jesus' own followers. I have quoted before, and I quote here again, a matchless sentence from my teacher, Professor George Caird. Thus in literal historic truth, not simply in theological interpretation, the one bore the sins of the many. Some theories of atonement detach themselves from the actual events and superimpose on, or even substitute for, the gospel narrative, a theological scheme of interpretation culled from elsewhere, in order to explain how sinners may ultimately leave this world and go to heaven. Such theories are no better, at the level of a proper theological method, than theories of the kingdom which ignore the cross. Kingdom and cross belong together. The whole story is the whole story. And it is within that whole story, not within some truncated version, that Jesus' call to a new creation kind of virtue makes the sense which it does. Jesus' call to follow him, to discover in the present time the habits of life which point forward to the coming kingdom and already, in a measure, share in its life, only makes sense when it is couched in the terms made famous by Dietrich Bonhoeffer, "Come and die." Jesus didn't say, as do some modern evangelists, "God loves you and has a wonderful plan for your life." Nor did he say, "I accept you as you are, so you can now happily do whatever comes naturally." He said, If you want to become my followers, deny yourself. Take up your cross and follow me. Mark chapter 8, verse 34. He spoke of losing one's life in order to gain it, as opposed to clinging to it and so losing